You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Now the floor is open to questions, and if you want to, you introduce yourself as this morning, and if you have a question to one of the panelists, please direct it to them, and then I suggest that we take questions, and towards the end, each one of you will get 1 minute just to provide general comments. So the floor is open. Yes, I see two of you. Yes, so please introduce yourself. You can
for me. Yeah, thank you very much, Petra. Yeah, before raising my question, I want to make a short comment. That local development, of course, it's linked with sustainable development, but local development doesn't mean rural development. And the concept of rural development is still running since many decades, and it is linked also with gender dynamics. But local development, when we said local development nowadays, we are thinking also about local governance and local authorities, which means autonomy of the province, of the districts, which means also maybe local government, local parliament, and mainly financial autonomy. But my specific question for the about the emergent communities in Zimbabwe, I want to know which legal framework. And if those emergent communities are indigenous communities, but what is the legal framework and the district of the autonomy? I don't know if Zimbabwe is federal. And my second question is, how the migrants, how they can the contribution of migrants, because nowadays we recognize that the contribution of migrants, remittances, remains us. That's very important. Unfortunately, we didn't include in the 35 presentation in workshop and 4 in the other workshop, but la contribution financière des migrants, comment pourrait-elle être?
How could the financial contribution of migrants be incorporated into local development?
Thank you very much. I think we know to whom these questions will be addressed. But I think I suggest we take maybe 3 questions and then we go to your answers. Is that okay with you? Oh, I saw you, and then I see you, and then I see, okay.
Thank you. Bina Agarwal. I had a question to Michael Kanaris, and I wondered if you could tell us a little more about the women's producer groups, what led to their formation, you know, just what is the scale, how do they operate? You seem to imply that, you know, there are producer groups which have been made in order to deliver papaya, etc. And that sounds like contract farming, which you find in many parts of the world. Is it different from contract farming? Because contract farming is typically gives you all the risk and very little autonomy. And then on the women's producer groups, do they pool their land and resources, or simply are they just marketing together? Because the former has many more challenges than the latter. You also had a major land reform initiative, and has that initiative led to experimentation beyond the distribution of land to alternative formations of production, I mean, more collective production, for instance? Thank you.
Judith Hitchman, RIPES, and Urgency, which is the global community-supported agriculture movement. My questions are also to Mr. Canares. First of all, concerning the co-ops, you mentioned certification. I was wondering whether this is participatory guarantee system certification or whether you're using a heavier form, a much more expensive form of certification, such as ISO, because the PGS system is something that also heavily includes the social dimension, which is important in social and solidarity economy, and it is peer-reviewed, which again refers back to the practice of the solidarity economy. Secondly, in your presentation of the value chain, I was a little bit confused. I didn't quite understand when you came to talk about the consumer outlets, because I got the impression that you were talking about mainstream consumption in terms of your marketing. And I was wondering whether you actually are talking about that or whether you're talking about more direct forms of sales with community purchasing groups through cooperatives that are consumer cooperatives, and whether you are in fact managing to stay outside of the neoliberal system of consumption and moving towards some kind of responsible consumption. Because unless you have that final dimension of the chain, which is responsible consumption, including labeling and the kind of outlet that you're working through, you won't actually achieve fair prices for the farmers or any of the other members in the cooperatives throughout the value chain.
Thank you. So then the first question, I give the floor to Dr. Manasseh Chiweshe.
Okay. On the question of which legal framework are they operating under, I'm not too sure I understand the question, but basically these groupings remain informal. They're not formally registered, but they're not recognized by any formal authority. So they remain working parallel to the main systems. But Zimbabwe remains a republic with elections where the government is elected by the people. We're actually in the process of preparing for an election, which might or might not happen this year. But basically, these groupings remain informal. Maybe if we can discuss afterwards, then you can actually explain to me what you want to understand by a legal framework. Then I can be able to help. But on the issue of migrant economies have been important for us because approximately 3 to 4 million Zimbabweans live outside Zimbabwe. Mainly in South Africa, England, Australia, New Zealand, and Botswana. So migrant communities have been also important in terms of our remittances. But you find that in the area that I was working in Mazowe, very few people had relatives or had families or people who were living outside the countries. So that notion of migrant economies bringing financing for them was very limited because they did not have anyone. But generally in Zimbabwe, surviving the crisis post-2000, the economic crisis that we went through, migrant communities have been very, very important because most of them were actually propping up families and through sending back remittances. So they were very important in Zimbabwe.
Thank you. And I think we have other speakers who may want to intervene on the topic of solidarity financing through remittances. So.
Yes, I don't think we have to blow it out of proportion, although it is important, this role of migrants. On the one hand, the principal beneficiaries of remittances such as of migrants are countries like France. That is to say that these countries do also have their own migrants, and they receive money back from them, and this is quite significant. If we look at the statistics, usually, we don't look at the flows going back to the developed capitalist countries. Secondly, there's a large portion of this which is deferred consumption. Why? Because the families, generally speaking, although obviously if we look at certain regions such as estate purchasing, migrants simply flow their portion of the investment into that of the family as a whole. And their proportion stands only at 10% within the amounts of money invested by the whole family. If we look at the example of Haiti, for example, the sum of the remittances from migrants is quite significant, but the internal lottery actually mobilizes a larger proportion of money than the money coming from migrants. And so it's quite clear, if we look at the issue as a whole, that it needs to be set against the other financial securities and insecurities being experienced by the population. So I think it is a significant subject to some degree, but it has been exaggerated, generally speaking, in terms of a development factor. It's something that I looked at during the 80s. I looked at village saving associations found across the world. Some Senegalese examples were one example of an informal fund transfer activity. There were collective activities to set up or build a bridge or provide transport services, but it was something that was very limited while promising. But it shouldn't be exaggerated, the scope of this phenomenon.
Thank you. Anyone else who would want to comment on this? And otherwise, I'll give the floor to Mr. Canyares.
I'd like to start off with the last question and then proceed to Bina's question on gender and development. So the last question, in the Philippines, there's a Philippine Council for Organic Certification, which is essentially a multi-stakeholder body which screens and provides certification for organic products in the country. This is actually this also involves government agent and a government agency, more particularly the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Science and Technology. But it is not a political body because it has to be shielded from political intervention. So there's that organic certification process. Regarding the value chain, this is actually they actually have an outlet. They call it a bagsakan center or something like a place where you drop off the products, which is actually done by the marketing cooperative actually brings that to the bagsakan center. Apparently, at this stage, the primary consumers are in the mainstream, essentially hospitals, hotels, and supermarkets. So if you look at that, it's essentially dependent on the mainstream economics, the economic actors as the providers of as the main buyers of the produce. However, because there are only very few organically certified producers in that particular province and region as well, so they're able to command better prices for the products as compared to the previous time wherein there was only one private entity that's doing the tracking as well as the marketing. Yeah. So for the question on land reform and its association to how things have been reorganized as production structures in the communities, it has. Unfortunately, the Philippines has a protracted land reform program. The government cannot make that big political decision to redistribute the land as what has been contemplated by the Comprehensive Agrarian Reform Plan. So it has ended in 2012 with less and less impact, and so they decided to extend it again. So you have this kind of a view that some of the government is actually wanting to do it for political reasons, but not actually wanting to do it because majority of the those sitting in the House of Representatives and the Senate are landed landlords. So has it actually changed agricultural production? The government tried. This is not a bottoms-up approach, but rather a government-led initiative to organize the producers into community associations and groups. They call it agrarian reform beneficiaries, who does collective marketing, collective production and marketing. In some cases, it's successful. In most cases, it isn't, especially because in a context wherein in the context of agriculture, when you have somehow a long-term gestation period, they go back to the, there's a sliding back to the normal way of doing things, wherein they get indebted to the landlord for farm inputs, and then eventually the land is sold back to the landlords and their descendants. So you have that kind of a mechanics in there. Regarding the involvement of women, the women actually are also involved in the live farms, the farms itself. But the producers groups, that they call it producer group, but it actually it's a manufacturing plant, wherein the women are the ones that are there. It's actually born out of the need to participate in farther in the process. And there was a participatory exercise which was conducted by MUWAD as to how they will deal with the excess production and those substandard ones. So the papayas, for example, that doesn't fit into the standard sizes, which are, well, commanded by the normal market players, the regular market players. So that's actually what happened. And so the organization was made based on that context.
Thank you. So now we can go to the second round. I already had two persons ask for the floor. I see... Okay, I have five people, so let's go for five questions this time. So it's Ms. Hillenkamp who gets to.
Thank you. Just a question for Manasseh Chouéché. You can hear me through translation. I was interested by your analysis of the way in which the agricultural reform process in South Africa gave rise to the emergence of economy and solidarity institutions. But I'm interested about the degree to which the process is inclusive, because in South Africa, certain analyses, for example, by Walker, have cast into doubt the extent to which agricultural agrarian reform has been inclusive, particularly with regards to women included by masculine authorities in rural communities, and to what extent they can access that. Is that something you've been able to take into account, and which you've seen in the Zimbabwean case? Or have these obstacles been overcome? I'm thinking also of ethnic exclusions or any other types of exclusions, because I think maybe inclusion isn't a natural process, but must arise from a process. Thank you.
The floor is yours.
Garen Seppem from Safe Observer International. I was very interested by the presentation by Mr. Batman on state support, because we have a problem today, which is one of the major problems is the deregulation, and deregulation prevents the kind of solidarity economy that we would like to have. A related question and a story. I happen to be part of a movement called the People's Health Movement, which is global. And our founder, who is also the founding father of Bangladesh, as a physician called Dr. Zafula Chowdhury, the other day, I'm an economist, but I've been involved in health for 30 years. But anyway, I started discussing economics of Bangladesh with him a little bit. Usually we always talk about health. And I said, what do you think about Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank? He said, you mean Shylock? I said, no, I meant Yunus. And he said, yes, you mean Shylock. In other words, living in Bangladesh, a man who has actually lifted 1 million people to the level of meeting the MDG in terms of health, education, gender development, and so on and so forth, is totally against Mohamed Yunus, even though his model of economic development has been reported by the UN to be a model that if we could extend that to the rest of Bangladesh, Bangladesh would meet the Millennium Development Goals in terms of fighting against childhood diseases and poverty. So I happen to have read and translated some of your article, Mr. Batman, on microcredit, and I wanted you to say a few words about that today, because I think it's very important. Thank you.
Thank you. I saw Mr. Coraggio asked for the floor. I didn't see you before. And there was a lady up here as well. Yes. Okay. So we can take Mr. Coraggio, then you, and then you, and then we go to you. Okay. We take 6, 7. Okay.
Thank you. I want to comment on Jean-Michel Servais' analysis of the little importance of remittances. I think that they are very important. First, because of the huge qualitative effect on the local communities. These remittances imply the fragmentation of local communities in this side of the world. And this is really, for instance, in Mexico, is very, very important. The second question is that about the quantity. In many of our countries, is the first or the second source of foreign currency. This has an effect in the balance of payments. Even if the money is spent in local consumption, it has an impact in the macroeconomics of these countries. So I think these aspects should be taken into consideration. I would like to know the comments of Jean-Michel.
Thank you very much. And now I'm abusing of the floor, because previously to coming to Geneva, I was serving in Cape Verde. And there, until recently, remittances were actually the largest contributor to the economy as well. So I think they had a real impact on local development, employment, etc., construction.
Thank you. Julia Sajbien, Dalhousie University and Universidad de Puerto Rico. I have a question for Mr. Cañares. If he would kindly comment on his last slide, I found it very interesting and an entire opening of possible other topics about developing a model that is not an anti to something, but perhaps a positive description. Thank you.
Thank you. And the gentleman in front.
Thank you. I'm Professor Ben Dell with the University of Cumbria in the UK. It's great to see the issue of community currencies well represented on this panel and indeed in this conference. So my question to Jean-Michel Servet and Marie Fair is, in your experience, to what extent are practitioners in this broad field of the social and solidarity economy aware of the role and or even just existence of community currencies? How much is it emerging also as a theme in the broad field of SSE? That to me would be interesting. And if there's change there or if there are things that arguments that need to be made to bring it more centrally into the SSE, what are they? Thanks.
Thank you, and a very nice and even distribution to the different panelists. You, sir, have the floor, and then we close for this round.
Yes, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This question is mainly for Mr. Cañares. Yes, I was very impressed by your lecture. I have some question to ask you. You know that we need about 600 million jobs in the next 10 years. You have 200 million young people without work. There's a question of climate change as well and the consequences. So my question is the following one. How do you think those informal economies and new type of SSE can reduce those difficulties? Because at the end of the day, this is what we want to tackle with SSE. Thank you.
Thank you. So then again, I think we start as previously. We start with you, Dr. Shiwesha, for the first question.
Okay. My question was about inclusion and exclusion within this process. So I think I'll talk about inclusion and exclusion on two levels. First of all, the program itself in Zimbabwe, the land reform program itself in Zimbabwe. It is a question that I tried to run away from, but I'll just talk about it. There are certain things when you're looking at inclusion and exclusion of the whole program. One of the fundamental issues or the fundamental accusations was that it was political elites who got land. But a country with 145,000 political elites is a bit tricky. So that question itself is something else. But when you're looking at issues around gender now in children, the issue of gender is to be understood within the patriarchal nature of Zimbabwean. I say Zimbabwe loosely because Zimbabwe is made up of different ethnic groups. But generally speaking about a Zimbabwean context, the assumption when the land reform started, and this is the problem that we have had since the program started, because you find that only 18% of women, I say only, given that the target was around 30 to 40% of women got land in their own right. But that in itself was a very, very successful issue because the problem with how land is conceptualized as a property in terms of patriarchal notions is that land is owned by ancestors. It's an ancestral collective. So it's the ancestors of male relatives, as it were. So the issue of patriarchy becomes important in terms of can women access land in their own right within this space. So that is a bigger question around the exclusion of women. Though they are not exclusion per policy per se, policy did not say that women cannot access land in their own right. But due to cultural constraints, you find that women would go register for land, and when they get it, they would put it in their husband's names, those who were married. So seeing women specifically got land in their own right, about 18% of women got land in their own names in their own right. But there was no policy blockage in terms of saying that women cannot access land in their own right. But rather cultural customs and norms made it impossible for certain women, especially those who are married, to access land within their own right. So exclusion in that way within the program was experienced that way. Then I would like to talk about exclusion within the groups themselves. You find that the groups themselves, if you're also not careful in terms of looking at social solidarity, that building institutions, cooperatives, groups can also become exclusionary in many instances. I came across certain groups where you needed to pay to get into the group, like in the irrigation community. Your membership depended on whether you could pay. So those who could not pay could not irrigate. They could not get access to the irrigation equipment. So cooperatives groups can also become exclusionary in terms of, can you afford to get into that group? What are the criteria or the criteria involved in selecting people who are supposed to join the group? Are you of the right ethnic group? Because ethnicity also plays an important part for us in terms of accessing land also. Are you from, which region are you from? Are you the correct ethnic group? Are you from the correct family? So in a way, that question of exclusion is important. Before we start romanticizing some of these institutions and groupings, we also need to understand how they can also lead to excluding certain groups. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the second question was mostly addressed to Mr. Bateman.
The issue of state support, I think, is really important because, as I said in my paper, that we all are agreed to the issue of solidarity economy is very important, but it's a question of how we actually get there. And my own opinion is that, I mean, I think NGO capacities and other sorts of non-state capacities are important. But the primary focus, as we see from economic history, is that unless we have concerted state support behind a particular enterprise development trajectory, we simply won't see it. And in terms of cooperatives, I think that has to come at the local level. In Eastern Europe, where I'm mainly based, one of the biggest reasons for the complete collapse of the Eastern European economies after 1990 was that the international development community insisted that they have no institutional capacity to support business. It would be a purely market textbook approach, and we would see all these new enterprises emerge spontaneously. Completely wrong. It's been a complete disaster. Moving on to Bangladesh, I think there are two important points in what you've said there. The first one is that I wouldn't say Professor Yunus was a Shylock. I wouldn't use that term. I would say something like faith healer, because you've quoted something there, 2 million people. It hasn't happened. There's no evidence anywhere that there is any connection between the provision of microcredit in Bangladesh and poverty reduction. There is zero evidence of any connection. Even the World Bank now, in its reports, will make no connection between poverty reduction. I was at a meeting in Canada, in Ottawa, and I sat next to somebody who was in the microcredit summit, and this person said, but we've had a 20% decrease in poverty over 20 years and a 20% increase in microcredit over 20 years. That must indicate something. And I said, well, no, because we've also had a 20% increase in cricket clubs, a 20% increase in McDonald's. The key issue is causation.
You misunderstood me. Maybe my English was not very good. I mean, Dr. Saifullah is responsible, covers an area of over 1 million people in Bangladesh with a PHM movement covering health, education, and everything. He's the one. And the UN, the WHO, and so forth say if he could only extend his system toward Bangladesh, Bangladesh would move towards development.
Okay.
And this man, this founder of Bangladesh, says that Mohammed Yunus, he hates it. He says it's usury. It's accumulation on the...
Sorry
for interrupting, but you misunderstood me.
No, sorry. Okay, but okay. Well, I made a point anyway. I think the other important thing that has to be made in terms of Bangladesh is that because, and again, it goes back to the issue of causation, Bangladesh has got almost the weakest state capacity in all of East Asia. And it's that is fundamentally related to the fact that it's one of the poorest countries in East Asia. Now, the NGOs like BRAC and Grameen and Prashika will say that we are covering for state capacity that does not exist. Therefore, we're doing a good job. Whereas others would say that, no, the reason we don't have any capacity is because, first of all, the international donors prevented it arising, and they would prefer it to be in non-state sectors. And so that's one of the reasons why Bangladesh is so poor. It hasn't developed the state capacity. It has a very much poorer second choice of these NGOs, which basically promote what it is that they want to promote, particularly microcredit and nothing else. So I think that's one of the reasons why that, in a sense, goes to the argument that I'm making, that if we only have weak NGO-style support for enterprise development, we end up in a Bangladesh-style situation dominated dominated by informal micro-enterprises and postage stamp farms. So I think that's not an outcome that we want.
Thank you. And then we had the question about remittances.
In relation to the comment by José Luis, I would say that this session has to do with solidarity, so to speak. Now, in general, do remittances have a macroeconomic impact? So I situated myself from this perspective. So you have, for instance, solidarity-based investments. But what's very interesting, if you take the example of Mexico, in 2008, given the crisis in the U.S., we saw people, for instance, households, take out microfinance loans in Mexico to send money to the U.S. because the coyotes, the people smugglers who needed the $1,500 or $2,000 to have smuggled someone into the U.S. And also, you have to look at the remittances as a whole. For instance, with regard to Sub-Saharan Africa, we often say that remittances account for a substantial share and so on. That's true. But there's also an excess bank liquidity in Sub-Saharan Africa. It's calculated that about 50 out of 54 Sub-Saharan African countries have excess liquidity in banks. People are actually sending money into the world financial system. So that poses a number of problems, believe me. It also raises a certain number of questions if you look at these monetary flows, financial flows as a whole. So I won't deny the macroeconomic impact of these remittances. I think that is clear. But if we look at the utilizations in terms of solidarity, so to speak, and participation in the solidarity-based economy, clearly this is a little bit like fair trade, which accounts for a small share of world trade. We're not saying that it's not significant, but in terms of the overall proportion, as an old philosopher quoted by Marx said, quantitative differences produce qualitative differences, and we have to factor this in. We have to remain hopeful, but really remain grounded in this reality.
My suggestion is that we actually leave your two questions to last, and we continue on the financing issue, the question to Marifar and Jean-Michel. So, yeah.
Okay, so the mic is on, and I'll continue. Now, what I find striking with regard to the local currencies and the role that they play also with regard to the whole process of reflection, about 10 years ago, there was an interview in the La Revue Banque, which is a magazine for the bank managers. It's not really an alternative style publication. If you look at the articles, I had an interview, and I'm not saying that I'm someone who's really formal bank system oriented, but so they had an interview about a four or five page interview, and I was a bit surprised, and they called this another system of values or another value system. So I think that this is noteworthy to point out that there could be other examples. We could say that there is a different way of operating, a different way of functioning. So what they found very striking, because I had a long discussion with the journalist, because they had the idea that, for instance, local currencies in Europe, that's really developing in Spain, in Greece. Now, so this implies that this is something for the poor, because they have a parallel economy, because they can't break out of this, so they're relying on these alternative currencies. And I said, no, you're wrong there. Those who really rely on these complementary currencies are social groups which are not necessarily the most underprivileged. This means that the crisis really generates a search for something else. And I think that more than efforts to combat poverty, if we take the example of Spain, where, for instance, there are a great many of local currencies, this is really the main thrust. If you look at the city of Nantes, in Mr. Ayrault, the prime minister, was from Nantes, and there was an effort made to introduce a local currency and to promote local trade in the city. This is not really based on efforts to combat poverty. This might be regrettable, but you could also say that this is an important initiative. This was an experiment, and you could think that change with regard to the social and solidarity economy depends on an increase in the number of experiments like this, and also an increase in the number of models of complementary currencies. So I think that what we're seeing now, it's more important in terms of a cultural alternative. This is more important than a practical economic alternative. And so when we have to look for something else, look for something fundamental, and this will also enable an increase in the number of alliances and partnerships between the stakeholders. This is important. And here in Geneva, thought is being given to the introduction of a local currency. It's not because in Geneva we lack suitable financial management of resources. No, that's not the problem. So I would just like to complement what you said. I think that what explains the lack of interest or in terms of the social and alternative currencies is the idea that these were very limited experiences, too limited to really be observable, even though an effort is being made to scale them up. But there's also a lack of knowledge in an initial phase of what these are used for and how they operate, because these mechanisms also rely on a certain cross-cutting dimension with regard to practices and disciplines, and this makes them a little more difficult to comprehend. There is another explanation based on the lack of impact studies that have been carried out on these mechanisms, even though, as I said, these started to emerge in the 1980s, and more studies were done on such experiments. Researchers were working on them, and now there's a community of researchers that has formed around these issues. What we see, to put things in perspective, there is growing interest of actors in the field, whether this be in Europe or in Latin America more and more, but also in Africa and in Asia as well. There is a strong interest in local communities and local authorities in precisely this kind of issue, and sometimes this is actually there's legislation that's adopted to facilitate this. Now, as I see it, three arguments are key when it comes to justifying or illustrating or showing exactly how these currencies can really be fully integrated into the subsidiarity economy. These are tools for mobilizing actors in territories, and the main players in territories are the people who play a specific role within these territories. And the second argument is that we are going to be introducing governance based on partnerships that is renewed within the framework of co-construction with actors who are both citizens, producers, also the local authorities, sometimes banks as well, and they are all going to come together and pool their interest in a project that brings together sometimes very varying forces. And it's also a tool for development that will be geared to social innovation and experimentation with the end goal of social transformation, societal transformation. Here, this brings me back to the concept of alternative, and this is really at the heart of solidarity economy or social economy. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Kanyaris, you have the floor.
I would probably make a remark on the last two questions together. I'd like first to make a comment that much of the literature on social and solidarity economy in the Philippines, and Asia for that matter, for example, actually have organizations or institutions as units of analysis. So you practically don't look into how goods are being produced, how these are being transported to markets, how are these being consumed. So sometimes you have a view, you kind of have a view that studies are essentially conducted essentially on alternative players or alternative stakeholders in the economy, and we're not really talking about an alternative world. Because for me, if you'd like to talk about an alternative economy, if you need to restructure the economy around social and solidarity, then you have to study from producers up to the end of consumers. Now, in the case of the country, for example, we don't really have a persuasive data to say that if consumption matters. What I mean is, if goods produced under an alternative model actually matters to consumers. So, like, for example, the case that I'm pointing to you about is essentially dependent on mainstream economic actors to be able to bring in the profit to those that are being involved in the production process. So I think there's a lot of a challenge of restructuring that. I mean, looking at the argument from the on the basis of a value chain or from on the basis of a whole landscape of actors. So the guy over there talks about the local economic development also involving, for example, the governments. And we've said that. In the case, for example, we see that the governments are not actually acting on requests for better roads so that goods can be produced and they can be transported in their form to the markets. So if you come to think of it, in the Philippines, there's a rising movement for responsible consumption, but that's very minimal as compared to those who would like to buy goods that are so cheap coming from neighboring China. So, I mean, like for me, for example, or for all of us here, does it matter for us that we are consuming the kind of products that are actually brought about by social and solidarity economics? But because if we're not asking that ourselves, then why are we talking about these things in the first place? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We started with a couple of minutes delay, so if there's somebody in here who's got a burning question, please raise your hand now. Okay. Two people. That's it. I close the list, and then I give 1 minute, and it's not... Okay, I think everybody agrees we can have 3 questions, okay? Because we are generous. Okay, so please, shoot. And short questions, please.
Yeah, this is a very short question. Now, we are a little bit confused about this whole deliberations taking place here. Now, I always tend to think that in the mainstream economics, profit is the bottom line, single bottom line. Now, when we talk about SSE, we have to find new bottom lines, blended value organizations, and what are the other values that come in to the whole process of our economic production, consumption, and other activities. Now, with all these microcredit or value chain analysis, I don't find that how the other values are really added, or as we go up, scaling up, I have a feeling that the other values recede into the background, and this whole economic values, they assume predominance in the sustainability debate of these alternative forms. So we are caught up in a, not dilemma, but we are locked up in a iron case, and this we need to, very powerfully I argue, we need to move out from in the whole framework of SSE.
Thank you. One of you will have to volunteer to answer this question. Yes, please.
Je vais parler français.
I'm going to speak in French. It's not really a question, it's a comment. The panel discussion had to do with the linkage between local economic development and the SSE, but there's a term that's really missing in the way that things were taken up by the various keynote speakers, and that is planning. If the economy is supposed to be solidarity-based and provide a viable alternative in today's world, if we fail to speak of the framework within which it must rethink the whole way of we creating a society together and organizing this transition, we cannot fail to take up the idea of planning. This is still a taboo word even today, but this whole idea of networking, refounding the whole idea of local networks, and we can see clearly that in the different presentations, because I also work with complementary currencies. Today, complementary currencies, as the keynote speakers said in their answers to the questions rather than in their actual presentations, this takes up once again the way in which we look at the framework and invite all of the partners to really challenge the framework. This is not so much the case for the instruments, SSE instruments, without making a link with the microcredits, with the cooperatives, and so on. In the discussions we've had since this morning, this dimension has really disappeared, but this is really at the heart of the whole concept as it is put into practice.
Thank you. And the last question goes to you.
Thank you. I'm David Barkin from Mexico. I was surprised at Bateman's presentation because it seems to me that you finesse, to not use another word, the problem of the difference in the strategies that a state uses, especially in Latin America, to promote development, and the contradictions that state-led development has and is creating all over our region, and the notion of state-led local development. In fact, in almost every country I can think of, the state is viewed as the enemy for local development efforts, and particularly for those efforts involving the state, involving what might be called the social solidarity economy. I'll go further as a provocation. Even in Cuba, there's a problem of a contradiction between the superstructural conviction of market-led development and the efforts by many local groups, worker groups, peasant groups, to try to have greater control and some mechanisms of protection against wholesale exposition to the market.
Thank you. Now I suggest that we go from this end and you can comment on the questions posed or anything that you would like to add, or if you say this is enough, you're free to do so. So please, Mr. Canales.
So, with regard to the other benefits, in quotes, of the SSC, well, I would say what I experience is the additional social link that this can create in a society that has dissolved this link and replaced it by mechanisms. Now, I'm going to rely on storytelling, which is used often with regard to microcredits. I was a real advocate for the system of local trade in France 15 years ago. People said, well, what's the point? So let me just tell you this following anecdote. I was in the Seine-et-Lond region, and these were very poor people who were members of the group in question, and I was carrying out surveys, but I was also a member of this group, so I greeted her, and she said that this is the first time I've ever kissed a faculty professor on both cheeks. And this kind of really reflected the break, and she said something, you know, I have a problem. And in these groups, you're a little bit worried when people say this. And she said, I have a handicapped son who's 15 years old and who weighs 100 kilos. And before, I just wore old recycled clothes. I got old clothes for him. But now, thanks to this system of local trade, this has really helped a lot. And there are two seamstresses within the group. And that way, he can actually have clothes that young people wear. And this really was a good example if you use the storytelling method. So these systems, this might be compensatory mechanisms, but this is kind of the human dimension, so to speak. So I would just like to say that sometimes in with regard compared to a real formal evening, I prefer just a little tiny breakfast. Perhaps in Latin America, things have moved forward a bit more, but in the European countries, in any case, this is a secondary stage. First, you have to act, you have to implement this break, you have to introduce this. And here I'm really basing myself on my position here as a European. You have to incorporate two things into the solidarity economy. This is often conceived on the basis of mechanisms of trade, donations, reciprocity, and so forth. Planning can become an element, depending on how it's organized. But I would say that you have to give thought to the concept of notion of sharing. And this is a gradual break, but a considerable break in relation to what we have experienced over the past 25 years. Moreover, this is the neoliberal model of financialization, and this is very weak in the SSE, but you have to introduce the thought in relation of changing the way you conceive of production, not just consumption, transfer, and financing. But this is a process that will take, I think, at least one generation. This is what I fear. This is one factor to be borne in mind. And I think that some people could imagine that you could have a more radical break, that this could be another possible way. Personally, I see things from a much more gradualist perspective, even though I share the end goal, so to speak.
So, Mr. Siwesh.
Okay. Maybe mine is just over a comment, specifically also responding to Professor Dash, that when you're looking at where I come from, we've got this element called Ubuntu. I am because we are. You are looking at the collective rather than the individual. I think from such rich history of cooperation, norms of humanity and helping each other, we can begin to see and to learn, especially from these groups, to learn how people use their own cultural norms and values in terms of linking these about helping each other, about ensuring that whatever I do does not degrade my neighbor in any way, but rather it's about the collective and not the individual. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bateman.
Okay. That's a very good issue in terms of the way that the local state has very often been perceived as being anti the local economy in many respects. But, I mean, we've lived through 25 years of an ambience created by neoliberal policymakers where we've almost come to hate the idea of the state. We don't even appreciate that it can actually be on the side. It is part of the, it's one of the tools of the of democracy. And I think that is changing now. I mean, I think in other countries, in European countries like Northern Italy in particular, Germany, the Scandinavian countries, the state isn't really seen as an enemy. It is seen as an enabler of local development in a very positive way.
Thank you very much.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.